You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the second part of our series on the history of anesthesia. So if you haven't already heard part one, you should go back and do that. But even if you have heard it, you're going to find this opening a bit disorienting. Ready? Picture a tumbleweed rolling silently across a dusty road in a wind-swept desert. The bristly ball flies right by the spurred cowboy boots of a mysterious stranger, like it's running for cover, the way the rest of the denizens of this one-horse western town already have. All but one. The sheriff. Star upon his vest, white Stetson upon his head, is the only one willing to oppose the murderous black hat. I'm giving you to the count of 10 to clear out of my town, prairie dog Doug, he shouts, his hands holding steady at his waist. The camera pans and zooms to prairie dog Doug, his eye twitching in the high noon sun, his three-day stubble surrounding a nefarious sneer. I'm giving you 9 to get out of mine, he spits. The tavern doors slam closed. Ladies in petticoats swoon. A dirty old whiskey priest jumps into a horse trough for cover as the two men begin to count up. 1, 2, 3. Everything's Dutch angles and Italian underscoring, with a stiff hint of Japanese samurai, yet it's the most distinctly American scene you could come up with. When the men yell 9, they draw and fire. Then, for a long pregnant moment, they each stand, casting long shadows in absolute stillness. A shimmer of light across their eyes in extreme close-up, shot, reverse shot. Finally, prairie dog Doug stumbles just the smallest bit and then falls dead to the ground. The townspeople explode into the street, their arms waving, their voices shouting. The music rises, the sheriff doffs his hat, the lady throws her arms around him, and they ride off into the sunset. All of this was made possible by an invention. Perhaps the most iconic invention in American history. The revolver. And in case there are any gun nuts listening, first off, wow, hello! Didn't expect to see you here. And second off, yeah, I know the revolver wasn't technically an American invention. There were a lot of rough attempts, most of them awkward and piecemeal, at making an effective revolver going back to at least the 1500s, but the creation of a reliable, compact, usable, mass-market, single-action revolver is a distinctly American thing. And it belongs to one man, Samuel Colt. It's safe enough to say that Colt was interested in guns and explosives from a very early age, and that by his late teens, he had come up with at least the rough shape of the weapon that would consume his life. When he was 16, he'd gotten into trouble when a 4th of July pyrotechnic he'd planned went awry and started a fire at his boarding school. His father, the owner of a Hartford, Connecticut textile factory, then sent him to sea with the Merchant Marines, where he probably had the idea for his revolver while examining the anchor windlass on board. When he got back to dry land in 1832, he convinced his dad to give him money to build a prototype. But when the now 18-year-old Samuel gave it its first test, it exploded. And that was the end of his father's encouragement. That might have been the end of the whole thing, and who knows how history might have changed, not to mention John Wayne's career. Samuel Colt had a big idea, but no way to make it manifest. Unless he could come up with a way to raise some serious seed money, his beautiful dream of a world filled with quick and convenient murder machines would never come to pass. But there was a way. Colt had spent a lot of time at his father's factory, and he'd hated it. So much so that he'd quit on multiple occasions, and between those times, he'd spent most of his time on the clock with the factory's head chemist, playing a little game called Let's Get High as Fuck. The chemist had taught him how to produce a gas that made the hours fly by in delirious laughter and laughing delirium. Now, at age 19, he took to the road to share that gas with paying audiences all across America. It started off as the lowest rent of operations. Colt, now calling himself Doctor and adding a pretentious U to the spelling of his name, traveled around the East Coast with a small wagon, hauling just what he needed to make the gas. He'd set up outdoors on a street corner, demonstrate his product by taking a big huff and stumbling around for a few minutes, and then he'd sell whiffs to interested passersby for a quarter a pop. Eventually, he made his way to Cincinnati, where his brother, John, helped him in the showmanship department, adding a glimmer of pizzazz and a thin veneer of legitimacy to the operation. Colt moved indoors to reputable theaters, where he gave highfalutin lectures about the nature of medicine and science and yada 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 before dosing up volunteers. It was probably for Colt's own sake that the lectures were glued onto his drug dealing. Colt really did believe that he was a man of science after all. Meanwhile, his audience was hardly lining up for edification. They were coming to get doped stupid and to watch their neighbors stumble around like idiots. That was a very good business model. Within a slim few years, Samuel Colt had raised the money he needed. He received a patent for his revolver, opened a factory in Paterson, New Jersey, and began manufacturing the first version of his weapon. A few years later, Sam Houston would ask him to make revolvers for the Texas Rangers, where they made an indelible name for themselves. Colt became one of the richest and most famous men in America. His guns helped define both warfare and policing for the 19th century and up until now. And he quietly tried to undermine Lincoln and the abolitionist cause from his home in the North while treating his employees as de facto indentured servants. Samuel Colt was a prick. But his days spent gassing up groundlings weren't unique. In the first half of the 19th century, there were a lot of people wandering around the United States giving out drug demos to all comers. If you were a New Englander looking for a fun theme for your seasonal soiree, you might get a chemist from the local university to cook up some gas for you and your friends to get all silly on. It was a popular mode of entertainment. And that is all it was. Even while, just down the hall from those chemists, surgical patients screamed out in unimaginable agony that could have been prevented if only the operations had been brought into Dr. Colt's extravaganza. Somehow, and it really is unfathomable, nobody put two and two together. Until the 1840s, when a chain of events and people as confusing and hazy as anesthetic itself changed everything. Today, we'll try to cut through it. This is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Today's episode, Comfortably Numb, Part 2. Hiring with Indeed? Your search is over. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Indeed is great. If you need proof, just know that in the time it takes you to listen to this ad, 23 hires will have been made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/The Constant. Just go to Indeed.com/The Constant right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/The Constant. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
By the year 1840, three effective general anesthetics were known and available. They just weren't known and available as general anesthetics. The newest of the three, and the one that will play the smallest part in this story, was chloroform. It was discovered in 1831 by four separate people independently. Each of them, however, had mistaken it for other related chemicals. And only one, Samuel Guthrie, a New York physician responsible for the invention of percussive powder, another milestone in the history of firearms, came close to gleaming its medical usefulness. Guthrie let numerous people into his office to get high on what he believed to be chloric ether, which he described as having similar effects to alcohol, sans the hangover. In his memoirs, he wondered whether a stronger dose might have a greater analgesic value, but never got around to testing this out. The French chemist Jean-Baptiste Dumas correctly identified the chemical makeup of chloroform several years later and developed a reliable process for producing it, but doesn't seem to have had any interest in what it could be used for. In 1842, the English physician Robert Mortimer Glover injected chloroform into a dog's neck and noticed that it rendered the animal unconscious, but before he could extrapolate a useful conclusion from that experiment, he became addicted to chloroform and using the stuff recreationally. He is sometimes known as the true discoverer of chloroform. We can come back to that claim later, and also sometimes known as the first person to die by accidental overdose on it. We can come back to that later, too, come to think of it. The second compound, already available in the 1840s, was the one Samuel Colt was touring around America, nitrous oxide. Nitrous oxide had been discovered in the 1770s by Joseph Priestley, who in the same spat of experiments had discovered several other gases, or as he called them, airs, including carbon monoxide, ammonia, and, most importantly, oxygen. All these things he did in an increasingly quixotic attempt to defend the beleaguered theory of phlogiston, that fire was caused by the escape of a fire-like element from within the structure of certain materials, We talked about phlogiston theory in the episode Walking on the Sun, so I won't bother explaining it any further here. I also won't spend much more time on Priestley, except to say that he is one of the more fascinating people you probably know little about, and Stephen Johnson's biography of him, The Invention of Air, is a truly delightful book. Do yourself a favor, go pick it up. In summary, Priestley's interest in nitrous oxide wasn't medical or even recreational. To him, it was a data point in favor of phlogiston theory. He named it dephlogisticated nitrous air. By the 1790s, people had picked up on Priestley's experiments and observations on different kinds of air and were beginning to try to find medical and scientific uses for those airs. But mostly that meant trying to treat tuberculosis and other respiratory diseases with them. Producing nitrous oxide was difficult, which eventually made it a profitable sideline for showman-come-drug dealers like Samuel Colt. But that difficulty is probably also responsible for one of the most baffling near-misses in scientific history. One of the few places kitted to churn out large quantities of nitrous at the turn of the century was the Pneumatic Institution for Relieving Diseases by Medical Airs in Bristol. The apparatus for creating the gas, and other potentially useful vapors, was put under the control of a young, untested chemist by the name of Humphrey Davy. Humphrey Davy, who would go on to be maybe the most important practical experimenter in scientific history, began his experiments huffing nitrous in a hospital basement. And he learned a lot that way. When Davy began his experiments, everyone assumed nitrous oxide was poisonous, because that's what Priestley had said. Davy, undeterred, made personally huffing the stuff one of his very first experiments, and established that it wasn't so much deadly as super fun! For the next few years, as his experiments at the Pneumatic Institution continued, he was hardly ever without a bag of nitrous. People reported seeing him skipping and giggling down the halls, then falling asleep in a corner, then inviting friends to do likewise. It was Davy who gave nitrous its most indelible nickname, laughing gas. After 2 years, he published a 400-page book devoted entirely to the gas. It was widely read, influential, and played a large part in securing Davy's future, where he'd do most of the important practical work on electricity and isolate a number of other important substances. Davy's book covered every data point he'd collected on laughing gas, but it stumbled when it came to asserting a use case for the stuff. On that score, Davy mostly recounted how much fun he and his friends had with it. And that was the takeaway that led to folks like Samuel Colt turning it into a psychedelic carnival game. But buried deep within Davy's book was one passage which history would look back on in perplexity. It stated that nitrous oxide, quote, may probably be used with advantage during surgical operations. What did Davy mean by this? He didn't say, and nobody asked, or paid any mind to his suggestion whatsoever for another 47 years. The third and final general anesthetic available in the 1800s has by far the longest history, ether. Ether was probably discovered somewhere between the 800s and the 1200s, although, as you can tell by that spread, discovered might be too solid a word for it. By the 1500s, it was being synthesized around Europe, and it's in that century that the alchemist Paracelsus noted it could be used to make chickens black out. But Paracelsus stopped there. And so, as with Davy 250 years later, a possible revelation was frustratingly, bafflingly postponed. Whereas nitrous oxide was relatively difficult to make, requiring specialized equipment and a small amount of expertise, ether was something any chemist could synthesize with widely available materials. It was cheap, easy, and virtually ubiquitous. Ether was the club drug of choice for 19th century New England hipsters, where commentators noted that any party, soiree, hangout, or meetup was bound to turn into an ether frolic if given enough time. Ether frolic was the preferred terminology, by the way, and in addition to being a catchy phrase, it captured the spirit of the thing perfectly. Ether could be inhaled or else drunk, a particularly popular delivery method in Ireland, where many Catholics swore off alcohol in the 1800s and found ether a convenient, if questionable, loophole. In many ways, the effects were similar. Like booze, a bit of ether seemed to intensify pre-existing emotional states. Like Davy's laughing gas, it could make for a really good time. But come in with melancholy, and you might come out sadder. Angry ether fiends were a surefire ticket to Fisticuffs City, and ether-fueled brawls could be particularly dangerous, since participants had a tendency to ignore the extent of their injuries. If someone took too much, the results were more predictable. They would knock right out, right where they were standing, and nothing would revive them for several minutes. This was looked upon as more of a bug than a feature. The greatest problem with ether, however, was the fires. Diethyl ether is extraordinarily flammable, bursting into flames with very little encouragement. If it hit a hot pipe, much less a struck match, even a stray static spark of the sort Humphrey Davy so famously experimented with was enough to turn an ether frolic into an ether conflagration. Making matters worse, ether is heavy and dense. You could be having a fun time getting stoned with your friends, totally unaware of the thick but invisible river of potential hellfire pooling around your ankles. Most terrifyingly of all, ether huffers and ether drinkers, who were also smokers, an almost perfect circle of a Venn diagram, I would guess, sometimes found themselves literally belching fire. Amazingly, the reported injuries from these events are mostly minor, but if it were me breathing fire after an ether and tobacco doubleheader, I think I might reconsider one or more of those hobbies. So that is the lay of the land. In the first half of the 19th century, people had fairly ready access to three separate potent anesthetics: ether, nitrous oxide, and chloroform. Each of them had been suggested or shown to at least mollify pain, if not eliminate it altogether. Yet, for some reason or reasons, nobody could see the solution directly in front of their literal noses. A lot of ink has been spilled trying to make sense of that, and I'm not sure anybody has come up with a fully satisfying explanation. Ether and nitrous were both probably overlooked in part because of their recreational reputations. We can see similar reluctance and dismissals today of drugs from marijuana to LSD to ketamine to psilocybin. But in those cases, the moral and legal trepidation is quite visible. In the 19th century, there's no sign of a Timothy Leary type trying to sell the public on the virtues of ether and being rebuffed. It just doesn't occur to anyone. And perhaps that is because pain was so omnipresent that people couldn't imagine doing without it. Or maybe surgeons were afraid of working without constant agonized feedback, because they usually only encountered silence walking alongside death. Maybe it was all of that and more. Who knows? It's totally perplexing. And almost as confusing is why the dams broke open as they did. People had been living alongside nitrous oxide and ether for decades, if not centuries, without ever getting wise. And then, over the course of a short couple of years, in the 1840s, the idea suddenly popped up in multiple places and people. And by the end of the decade, those people were duking it out over who deserved the credit, fame, and profit for the most important medical breakthrough that anyone had ever known.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Everybody, shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Any way you cut it, Edward Gilbert Abbott was an unlucky man. He was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1825 to Samuel and Harriet Ann Abbott. Little can be made of Samuel and Harriet from the existing record, other than that they both soon died of tuberculosis. Samuel when Edward was six, and Harriet Ann a year later. After their deaths, Edward inherited everything his parents had owned. This consisted of a couple flimsy pieces of furniture, four pewter table settings, some miscellaneous home goods, a couple tins of sugar, and a mountain of debt. He was thrown into a guardianship and all his meager belongings sold off to cover a portion of his inverted birthright. What came next for Edward Gilbert Abbott can't be said for sure, but he was probably apprenticed to a printer. This might have been a much belated stroke of luck. To be a printer would be a more respectable job than the bankrupted orphan could have reasonably hoped for. But in addition to want and abandonment, Edward Gilbert Abbott had also stumbled into a life of poor health, which kept him from keeping a regular job for long enough to pull himself out of abject poverty. Edward Gilbert Abbott owed his chronic sickliness to a large but otherwise benign tumor, which ran beneath his neck like a bullfrog's throat sac. It had been there, as far as the records are concerned, since birth, and though it was mostly soft and not terrifically intrusive, it filled up with fluid, and a single hard lump could be detected floating around somewhere in the depths of that fleshy water balloon. The tumor could be drained easily enough if you had the stomach for it, but there was no use to this. No sooner was it emptied than fresh fluid began pouring in, and in a matter of minutes the sac would once again reach its full girth. Abbott complained of frequent sore throats, colds, coughs, and the like. As I was saying, Edward Gilbert Abbott was an unlucky man. But that was about to change. It was the morning of October 16th, 1846, and Abbott had just been prepped for surgery. Why, at the age of 21, he decided to have his tumor removed is not explained in the medical records or the reporting of that day. We've got to presume the reasoning was serious, that he blamed the growth for his sickliness or feared it was cancerous. Maybe he was freshly in love and ashamed of his appearance. It must have been something like that, something severe. Because otherwise, why would Edward Gilbert Abbott have braved the blood-soaked coat and hot knife of the surgeon? After all, when he consented to the operation, Abbott had no idea that he would endure it without pain. John Warren, the surgeon in charge of Abbott's procedure, as well as a founder of Harvard Medical School, was unsure what his patient would feel either. For one, he was skeptical of the claim made by the barely practicing and unknown dentist who said he could render a person completely insensible to all pain via a special agent of his own formulation. But he had allowed William T.G. Morton a chance to prove himself there under the grand surgical dome of Massachusetts General Hospital on the morning of October 16th, 1846. And then, Morton had failed to show. The operation was scheduled for 9 a.m., but that hour had passed and then some, with no sign of the big-talking dentist. When the clock struck 10, the surgical team began making preparations to go on without him, but Warren told everyone to hold up and give him a few more minutes to show. For the students in the viewing area, it must have seemed like madness. Most of the witnesses to Abbott's surgery were unaware that there was to be anything special about it. The majority were students, who were required to view a certain number of surgeries as a part of their coursework, and others who wanted to get a look at Dr. Warren's surgical skill, which was valued as the greatest in the country. There weren't a lot of chances to see him work. Because surgery was such a heinous recourse, even the Grand Operating Theater at one of the most prestigious hospitals in the country, under its top surgeon, was used no more than once a week. When a surgery was scheduled, there was no room for dawdle or delay. Every minute a patient spent in anticipation was like a form of psychological torture. And every second spent under the knife wasn't just like torture, it was torture. Worse than most torture. So, to see Warren twiddling his thumbs as Abbott sat fastened to the hard surgical chair, surrounded by frightening saws and knives and hammers, must have seemed cruel, immoral. Sensing the mood in the theater, Dr. Warren moved to explain himself. Since many of you have not been informed what purpose you have been assembled here, I shall now explain it to you, he announced. There is a gentleman who claims he has discovered that the inhalation of a certain agent will produce insensibility to pain during surgical operations, with safety to the patient. I have always considered this an important desideratum in operative surgery, and after due consideration, I decided to permit him to try the experiment. That brief announcement couldn't have done much to ease the confusion. What Warren described was so foreign, so distant from any known experience, that it must have bordered on the unimaginable. If the spectators could bring themselves to believe it, what would they have pictured in their minds? What sort of agent? Delivered in what way? What would a painless surgery even look like? Sound like? Feel like? And, of course, there was the other incredulity, that the nation's top doctor had elected to give some random dentist this kind of trust, respect, and opportunity, and then that random dentist had just ghosted him? It appears, Warren added just before 10:30, he is otherwise engaged. The audience laughed, and Dr. Warren moved for his knife. He had given the dentist and his agent every possible allowance, but now he had to think of Abbott and his tumor. Warren was seconds away from making the first cut when William T.G. Morton burst into the operating theater trailing a strange device that looked like a tilted boiling flask with an extra tube coming off of it. Warren stepped back, his patience for the experiment nearly spent, and allowed Morton in. "Your patient is ready," he testily spat. Warren was understandably offended by Morton's lateness, which the dentist apologetically attempted to explain as he set up his apparatus. There'd been some last-minute complications with his tools, some fine-tuning he needed to complete before they could be used, he said. As he talked, he placed his glass globe on a nearby table and began pouring his secret substance into it. He checked the cork vent on the tube to make sure it was operating as intended, allowing fumes to pass through the tube and into the patient, but keeping his exhalations from returning back into the globe. It must have looked professional and competent enough. But what no one in the theater that day knew was that Morton had never seen this device until mere minutes before he entered. It hadn't existed before that morning, and he had had no practice with its functioning aside from what they were watching him do right there. Still, as far as Morton could tell, it looked like it would work. And here he was anyway, so what else to do but give it a go? He leaned over to Abbott and, with a surprisingly adroit bedside manner, explained what would, hopefully, happen. That Morton would apply the mouthpiece over Abbott's lips. that he would breathe normally, that the gas would make him feel peaceful, maybe tingly. Then he would fall asleep, and the operation would be conducted. That he would feel nothing, and that when he awoke, it would all be over. Morton's assurance to Abbott was kind and tender. It was also audacious and cocksure. And if events hadn't then transpired exactly as he'd said they would, he might have been run out of town on a rail. But after the mouthpiece was slipped over Abbott's face, he soon fell into a sleep so deep that few had ever seen anything like it. It would require the coining of a new phrase to describe it. People would say that Edward Gilbert Abbott was dead to the world. "Your patient is ready, sir," Morton shot back at John Warren. And indeed, he was. Warren made his first incision, 3 inches long, into Abbott's neck. The kind of incision he had made hundreds of times over the course of his career. But in every previous instance, that cut had been met with deafening cries, hideous screams, and contorting tensions of the body so intense that muscles might sprain and teeth might shatter. This time, there was nothing. Never in its history had the surgical dome of the Massachusetts General Hospital been so quiet. The patient made no move or sound at all, not the slightest wince or faintest murmur. The audience was nearly as silent as he. What they were witnessing was either a miracle or a murder, and none of them could yet tell which. The operation ran long, 7 or 8 minutes instead of the expected 5 or 6. While that was the sort of slack which ordinarily haunted a surgeon and a patient, of course, this time it was almost a relief. By the time Dr. Warren was wrapping up, Edward Abbott was stirring. He still couldn't feel any pain. He described a tight pulling and scraping sensation. But he was, without a doubt, alive and well. When the procedure was complete, Dr. Warren spun around triumphantly, his black coat caked in blood, both fresh and old, and announced to the entranced crowd, "Gentlemen, this is no humbug." It was a reference that very few people in the room were likely to appreciate, just as you, listening now, are unlikely to appreciate it. But the spirit was right, and everyone in the theater burst into rapturous applause. News of the incredible events which occurred on October 16, 1846 at the Surgical Dome of Massachusetts General Hospital seeped out slowly and unevenly. The very next day, like a child who'd just been given a quarter from behind his ear, the surgical staff begged William T.G. Morton to come back and do it again. Dr. Warren removed another tumor from the arm of a young woman. It was an even longer procedure than Abbott's, but Morton was on hand with his device the whole time, applying fresh vapor to keep the patient stupefied until it was done. When she awoke, she testified about the dreams she'd had during the surgery. She was so unaware of the pain that she had nothing to say about it. Physicians and chemists around Boston, as well as a school near Boston, if you catch me, began to gossip and ask each other what Morton's miracle vapor could be. Everyone who'd witnessed the gas in action could tell its primary ingredient had to be ether. The telltale saccharin-like smell was unmistakable. But there was something else to it, something citrusy, and Morton wasn't offering up any hints. Instead, he was putting out advertisements in newspapers and the pages of Scientific American, touting his discovery and offering up pain-free dentistry at a price. Not just pain-free, Morton said that under his watch, a pulled tooth would become downright pleasurable, which might even have been true, but what a weird thing to say. Eventually, the secret ingredient was unmasked: essence of orange peel. It had no pharmacological function, of course, but had been added to the mix to confound anyone who might want to try anesthetizing patients for themselves. Anesthetizing, as a word, by the way, didn't quite yet exist, not in the meaning it has today at least, nor did anesthesia, nor anesthetic, or any similar form. As the etherization process began to proliferate around the country and the world, some terminology was needed to describe it. It was Oliver Wendell Holmes who suggested anesthesia to Morton. It was useful to have a term less limited and specific than etherization, because soon the anesthetic uses of chloroform and nitrous oxide were being realized. All three of them had their problems. Ether was slow to work, required a high dosage, could cause severe nausea, and was, as already noted, shockingly flammable. Nitrous was difficult to prepare, difficult to administer, and generally considered a bit weak. And chloroform soon proved both addictive and toxic. Aside from those concrete issues, there were more ethereal, even spiritual, concerns. What was, people wondered, the function of pain? And was it really such a good idea to subvert it? This was a question not just of medicine, but of philosophy, even religion. Maybe a surgeon needed the feedback of a conscious and suffering patient to prevent injury. What about if, midway through an operation, the surgical team discovered a secondary issue that begged to be addressed? With the patient knocked out, they couldn't seek consent. Should they just make that judgment on behalf of the insensible, bleeding person laying limp in front of them? On a grander scale, people worried what it might mean to live in a world without pain. The hypergraphian librarian Robert Burton, in his Anatomy of Melancholy, had sagely observed that it is often suffering that curbs mankind's worst impulses. That sickness and pain can tame a person's cruelty, selfishness, and overweening ambition. If pain were no longer a moral force guarding humanity against its excesses, who might we become? In Burton's words, written 400 years earlier, we would become worse than tigers. There's a little Easter egg there for several hundred of you at most. And then there was the Christian angle. In Edinburgh, Dr. James Simpson, spurred on by the relative success of ether, had discovered, or else rediscovered, the usefulness of chloroform. He immediately put his new anesthetic to work on his patients, women in labor. To Simpson, alleviating the pain of childbearing seemed an obvious and noble pursuit, but he soon found that many disagreed with that assessment. The suffering of labor was the lot of women, a divine punishment visited upon the fairer sex as penance for Eve taking the forbidden fruit from the serpent and offering it to Adam. Anesthesia, to Simpson's detractors, wasn't just a potential medical, ethical, or philosophical bramble bush, it was literally satanic. All of these concerns were easy enough to voice when the speaker was healthy and the alternative hypothetical, but anyone actually facing the knife, or for that matter the forceps, was likely to see anesthesia another way, as a blessed and necessary relief. When Queen Victoria asked Dr. John Snow to anesthetize her for the birth of her eighth child, Leopold, even the religious scolds mostly shut up. It was a brave new world. The story of humanity's hardiest enemy, pain, had concluded with the happiest of all possible endings. As Jesus Christ had eliminated the sting of death, the burgeoning science of 19th century medicine had eliminated the sting of stings. Even that poor, unlucky orphan, Edward Gilbert Abbott, experienced a reversal of fortunes. After the operation, he felt his health much improved. He was able to seek work, eventually becoming an editor at the Boston Herald and the Boston Bee. He married a young, well-to-do woman by the name of Mary, and together they had a son, Edward Wellington Abbott, and a daughter, Mary Olive Abbott. All of this before Edward turned 40, at which point he died, like his parents had, of tuberculosis. So, no, not an unvarnished happy ending, but in his last 20 years, Edward achieved success and love and happiness and family, which would never have been available to him if William Morton had been a couple minutes tardier to the surgical dome. That dome, by the way, is still standing, Today, it is called the Ether Dome, and it serves as a museum to the history of anesthetic. Nearby, a tall marble statue juts out from a pond. Around its side are bas-reliefs with inscriptions commemorating the, quote, relief of human suffering, which occurred on October 16, 1846, a day which is known the world over as Ether Day. Just as William Morton is known as the father of anesthetic, with the inscription on his grave reading, "Before whom in all time surgery was agony, by whom pain in surgery was averted, since whom science has control over pain." Yes, it is a happy ending. Or it would be, if, in fact, William Morton were the father of anesthesia. If he were an honest dentist, rather than a serial fraud and con man. And if the idea and method for relieving pain had come first to him, rather than someone else from whom he had stolen it. Any or all of those things could be true. What's for sure is that Ether Day is not the end of the story. And the true ending isn't going to be nearly so happy. That's next time on Comfortably Numb, Part 3. Music for this episode provided by Epidemic Sound and Blue Dot Sessions. And the episode itself is provided to you by the patrons who make the continued existence of this show possible. So show them some thanks. Say it with me. Thank you, Bill Norris, LB, Adam Pritchard, Amanda Lord, Bruce, Wesley Song, Aaron Petty, Katie Wallace, and Ian Luna. Very good job. If you would like to join them and get access to new episodes early and ad-free along with monthly bonus content, navigate that fine ass of yours over to patreon.com/theconstant and sign up. Until next time, from Chicago, Illinois, home at one point to the American College of Dental Surgery, the first school to employ a full-time professor of anesthesia, George Leininger, in 1889, this has been The Constant.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.